very much for joining us out of your busy schedule today. We will now start the webinar entitled Like-Minded Allies: Indo-Pacific Partners' Views on Possible Changes in the U.S. Relationship with Taiwan. I will be serving as your MC today. My name is Murata at Sasakawa Peace Foundation Japan-U.S. Program webinar. So we will be starting the webinar now, and the theme of today's webinar is U.S.-Taiwan Policy and the Allies' Reaction to it. The research that is at the base of today's discussion is the comparative research conducted by the RAND Corporation in the U.S. with the cooperation from the Japan-U.S. Program. The outcome of the research was published in July this year, a report in English. As U.S.-China rivalry is getting more fierce, and with the visit to Taiwan by Nancy Pelosi last year, then Speaker of the House, as well as the statements made by President Biden, the debate over Taiwan policy in the U.S. has been growing from last year to this year. However, the debate in the U.S. over Taiwan policy is mostly focused on whether the strategic ambiguity should be maintained or not, and what kind of impact it will have on Chinese conduct. Whether the viewpoint of regional ally has been missing or not. This awareness of the issue is the background of RAND's research. We will hear about this from the researchers from the RAND Corporation later. So with this in mind, the focus has been placed on the U.S. allies, how they react and evaluate such policy changes in the U.S.-Taiwan policy. The report specifically focuses on Japan, South Korea, and the Philippines from four angles. The research has interviews of experts and people in policy circles at its core. In today's webinar, we'll talk about this content. We'll hear comments from the experts, both from the RAND Corporation as well as from Japan, to deepen this discussion on the current position of the U.S. and its allies over Taiwan. Let me introduce the five speakers today. First, from the RAND Corporation, Dr. Jeffrey Hornung, Dr. Miranda Pri, and Dr. Brown Rooney, who played central roles in authoring this report. Dr. Jeffrey Hornung, many in the Japanese audience may be already very familiar with him, but he specializes in Japanese security and foreign policies, East Asian security issues, as well as U.S. foreign and defense policies in the Indo-Pacific region, including its alliances. Formerly, he was with Sasakawa USA and then worked for the Daniel Inouye Asia-Pacific Center for Security Studies as the Department of Defense Education Facility, and he joined the RAND Corporation in 2017. He writes extensively for numerous media, policy, and academic outlets. Dr. Miranda Pri is Director, Center for Analysis of U.S. Grand Strategy and Senior Political Scientist at the RAND Corporation. Her work at RAND has focused on the future of the international order, effects of U.S. forward presence, military doctrine, history of U.S. military policy, distributed air operations, and multi-domain command and control. She has also conducted research on deterrence, reassurance, threat perceptions, rising powers alliance policies, as well as U.S. defense budgets. Dr. Brian Rooney, his work has focused on war gaming, U.S. cooperation with allies and partners, grand strategy, and deterrence from escalation in great power competition. Prior to working at RAND, his research also explored the interaction of domestic politics and international conflict, states of emergency in democracies, autocratic action, state capacity, and alliance dynamics. Next, the two commentators. from Japan. In the order of their intervention, Mr. Tsuneo Watanabe of Sasakawa Peace Foundation is a senior researcher, and Dr. Taya Kiba, associate professor at Kobe City University of Foreign Studies. Mr. Watanabe, I'm sure you are already very familiar with him. He worked at CSIS and then Mitsui and Company Global Strategic Studies Institute, Tokyo Foundation Policy Research, and has joined Sasakawa Peace Foundation in 2016. He is senior researcher of Security Research Group, implementing various projects. He also makes frequent appearances on the media. Lastly, Dr. Saya Kiba. She is associate professor at Kobe City University of Foreign Studies. She has experience as a practitioner working in the Embassy of Japan in the Philippines as well as in Thailand. She also has served as a staff member to a Diet member. Her major fields of interest are Southeast Asian studies, especially with Philippines and Thailand at the core. She engages in international joint research on pole-male relationship between Japan and Southeast Asia, security governance, and defense diplomacy. Details of the panelists will be available on the website of the Sasakawa Peace Foundation on the page where event information is available. Now we will hear about the overview of the report as well as updates on the environment since then. And there's going to be a 25 minutes discussion by the three speakers from the RAND Corporation, and that will be followed by 10 minute comment each by Mr. Watanabe and Dr. Kiba on Japan and South Korea as well as the Philippines respectively. So, without further ado, let us get started. And let me hand it over to the three experts from the RAND Corporation, Dr. Jeffrey Fornan, Ms. Dr. Miranda Priebe, and Dr. Brian Rooney. Over to you.
Thank you so much for your kind introduction, Aya-san, as well as we really just want to express our appreciation to you personally for all of your support, as well as to the Sasakawa Peace Foundation more broadly for the wonderful partnership that led to this report that we're going to talk about today. So just to give you a brief overview, I'm going to describe the project, why we decided to start it, how we went about it, and then Brian and Jeffrey are going to dive in and explain the findings in more detail, as well as discuss the implication of the United States and Japan. And then as Aya-san mentioned, we're going to have comments from experts and questions and answers. So before we get into the substance, I just wanted to remind everyone that this is a team effort. In addition to the three of us here today, we also had our colleague Patrick Hume, as well as Tamaki Nobuhiko and Inagaki Wu that were involved in the research itself. As Aya-san mentioned, we started this project because we really thought that the debate in the United States about Taiwan policy had become excessively narrow in a few different ways. Most importantly, it was focusing primarily on the question of whether the United States should maintain its traditional policy of strategic ambiguity, meaning that the United States does not explicitly commit to Taiwan's defense, although it provides arms and other resources, or whether the United States should switch to a policy of strategic clarity, meaning that it makes an explicit commitment to Taiwan's defense. And the three of us really felt that there was a broader, richer discussion that the United States should be having. First of all, we should be talking about a broader range of policy options the United States has going forward to signal what kind of relationship it wants to have with Taiwan. And second, we need to move beyond just thinking about China's reactions to US policy, but also to think about how allies would perceive those policy changes, and importantly, how they would react to them. So how do they change their policies as a result of changes in US policy? So with that, our main question that was driving all of our research is how would US allies respond to a change in US policy towards Taiwan? And we took four steps in order to try to answer this question. First, we looked back at the literature at changes in US policy towards Taiwan over time, and then looked at how allies responded to those changes historically. But the main thrust of the project was forward-looking. So we spent time thinking about how the United States could hypothetically change its policies in the future. And rather than looking in only one direction towards a stronger relationship with Taiwan, we wanted to also consider a looser relationship because there is a minority view in the United States that the United States should have a looser relationship with Taiwan. And so this report considers both sides. And the way that we assessed how allies might respond is both from that history of how they've responded in the past, as well as through interviews with experts and officials in Tokyo, Manila, and Seoul. So I mentioned a minute ago that one way we want to broaden this discussion is by talking about a broader range of policy changes that the United States could undertake. And so we group those policy changes. We have a long list, but just to give you a few examples, we talk about diplomatic policy changes like the number or rank of officials from the United States visiting Taiwan, the frequency or the content of statements that the United States makes about warning China against coercing or invading Taiwan, those kind of statements it makes with its allies, and of course, whether the United States makes an unambiguous commitment to Taiwan's defense. We also, though, looked at military policy changes that are possible, such as changes in peacetime, like U.S. presence in or near Taiwan, as well as different kinds of exercises or military training programs, really whether the quality or the quantity of those activities were to change. And then finally, we asked allies whether they would have a view about the United States having a closer or looser economic relationship with Taiwan, or increased or decreased intelligence sharing. So with that, I'll let Jeffrey explain what we learned about how Japan might see those policy changes.
I'm gonna talk about the findings in the case of Miranda. No worries. yes, I just wanna echo thanks to everyone who came here this morning. Happy to present some of this information for you. I'm going to walk through each of the individual cases and hit some of the higher points that come out in the report, some of the things that we really want to highlight. Starting with the case of Japan, we from our interviews, certainly our assessment is that Japan sees intrinsic value in the PRC not having control over Taiwan. We found that Japan's views on regional security largely aligned with the United States, and this extended to serious concern about PRC intentions. Obviously, the way that the two countries talk about the PRC is slightly different, but I would suggest that the concern is present and very clear. Particularly, we noted a fear that if Taiwan were to fall, the Senkakus might be next. So the fall of Taiwan to PRC control would continually put the PRC closer and closer to Japan. Further, we noted that control of Taiwan also enables China to control the sea lines of communication that are vital for Japan's economy. So much of the commerce, not just in the world, but specifically in this region and specifically for Japan, travels through the Taiwan Strait. And so there's significant concern that this provides China, who's already an economic powerhouse, with a lot of leverage over the economy of the region and of the economy of these states. Our sense was that Japan wants the United States to maintain stability in the Taiwan Strait while Japan is strengthening its armed forces and undergoing the types of changes that it's currently undergoing, as well as while Taiwan itself is building up its own organic capabilities. At the same time, we noticed a bit of tension because there was a desire for the United States to push back more against Chinese military coercion, both in words and in deeds. So there was a delicate balance to be struck. There was a desire for the United States to continue to push back and demonstrate what is necessary for deterrence while not causing such a change to the status quo that we would see instability. Next slide, please. The interviewees generally agreed that Japan would support increases in diplomatic, military, economic, and intelligence support to Taiwan, although not in every form that we discussed. We also would suggest that the interviewees said that Japan would adopt similar policies, but only up to a point. And a really instructive example here is that there was no evidence that Japan would follow the United States if it were to make an explicit commitment to the defense of Taiwan and do the same. And further, we know that Japan indicated that it would only support an explicit U.S. security guarantee for Taiwan if the United States were actually prepared to counter that military response. And so if there is not a sense that the United States is able to deal with the military threat that this poses, there's a reluctance to make such a strong commitment. That being said, it was very clear that Japan would oppose a reduction in U.S. support to Taiwan and would see this as indicative of a reduced commitment to regional security and to Japan's security. We'll note that there was a very significant belief that was pervasive in Japan, but not in the other locations necessarily to the same extent, that U.S. disengagement was very, very unlikely. The sentiment that we heard in Japan was that Japan would try and actively engage in discussions with the United States to prevent any level of disengagement. Our assessment was also, however, that if the United States were to do this anyway, Japan would probably maintain its relationship with the United States and perhaps seek to bring the United States closer to solidify that relationship despite their concerns. We did hear some discussion about how, given the concerns raised about the PRC, that Japan would not really be wanting to go at it alone in the future. And so this is another sort of piece of tension that we saw. I'll turn now to the Republic of Korea, which really highlights the differences in the cases. So South Korea sees Taiwan only as an indirect security issue. China is not the major security challenge for the Republic of Korea. Obviously, that's DPRK. And Taiwan's status has not historically been a security concern for South Korea. More recently, they've engaged in a lot greater discussion. This is an emerging policy area. This is not something that has been a historical focus. We found that Korea was more concerned about if a conflict happened over Taiwan, what would that mean for Korea and what would be asked of Korea? So the Republic of Korea was especially concerned that conflict might lead the United States to withdraw its forces from the peninsula, lead the United States to ask for ROK involvement or support, or even result in Seoul being a direct target of either China or the DPRK. So this was an area in which this was not a direct security concern, but there was fear that actions made to strengthen a relationship between Taiwan and the United States could eventually cause security concerns of its own. The perception in South Korea was that the status quo in the Taiwan Strait is highly favorable. But I do want to note that there was not an assessment that the way in which this status quo is being maintained was necessarily the ideal way of doing things. So there was a perception in Seoul that the United States should strike a better balance between deterring and provoking the PRC. But we'll also note that interviewees didn't agree on how the United States should strike this balance. There was a large sort of majority who suggested, if the PRC takes more aggressive action, the United States should be willing to push back. Whereas if the PRC were to take a more cooperative stance, the United States ought to do the same. But more generally, for some, the US response should be primarily military to demonstrate deterrence, while others were concerned that this might lead to even inadvertent escalation. And so while there was a sense that the United States was not striking the appropriate balance, there were a lot of disparate opinions on how that could be done. We note that ROK did not support increasing U.S. diplomatic and military support to Taiwan and would not be likely to adopt those policies themselves. At the same time, Seoul also opposed U.S. disengagement from Taiwan. And again, we saw the sort of consistent refrain that this would be a signal of warning for U.S. commitment to ROK security. Our assessment was that if the United States were to do this, The ARK would be likely to pull the United States closer, and they would also talked about increasing defense spending. So balancing both by pulling the United States closer and also internally balancing by building their own capabilities. I would note that our assessment was that Korean sentiment was somewhat of a mixed situation where some saw signaling commitment to Taiwan as a good sign for commitment to Korea, but they were afraid that this would eventually cause trouble and that this impact could reach Seoul. So that's sort of the high level takeaway. Lastly, talking about the Philippines, even more so than in Korea, at the time that we conducted our interviews, Taiwan status was very much not a top security concern for the Philippines. It was a very nascent concern, and a lot of the folks who we had talked about really highlighted how the thinking on the status of Taiwan was being developed as we were engaging in these conversations. It certainly was the case that Taiwan status was not a top security concern for the Philippines. Obviously, they have their own tensions with the PRC that are unrelated to Taiwan, as well as they have their own concerns about internal stability. And those have been historically some of the focuses of the Philippine government. But given its proximity to Taiwan, Manila was extremely afraid over the consequences of a war in Taiwan. There was a geographic focus to this simply by virtue of geography. Even if the Philippines were to prefer to avoid this conflict, they will feel some of its effects simply by their location. It's also the case that, much like Japan, a war in the Strait is going to hurt the Philippine economy. And in particular, overseas Filipino workers are relatively significant in Taiwan. And so one of the interesting points that we heard as far as why war was particularly a grave concern was simply how many Filipino overseas workers there were in Taiwan and what their status might be in the event of a conflict. One thing that we do have to note, and that is noted in our report, but was not captured at the time of our interviews, is that when we started doing these interviews, the Marcos administration was sort of in its infancy. And so it was very unclear at the time what the policy towards the United States, towards the PRC, and subsequently towards Taiwan was going to be. And the Marcos administration has been enabling greater US access and a greater rotational presence in the Philippines with the expansion of EDCA. They've also taken a relatively hard stance in the South China Sea towards PRC activities. This sort of fits with our assessment that Manila supports greater US regional presence, but they would prefer that it's not oriented on or near Taiwan. They do think that the United States serves a deterrent purpose, but they also prefer that the status quo is maintained. The Philippines did not support high-level U.S.-Taiwan diplomatic visits. The one consistent refrain we heard was about the Pelosi visit and how there was deep, grave concern over what that would mean for the relationship between the involved parties. Perhaps even more so than in any of the other countries we've seen, though this is a repeated refrain, decreasing U.S. support to Taiwan was definitely seen as an indicator of lower U.S. commitment to the Philippines. And this is true despite the fact that there is a mutual defense treaty between the United States and the Philippines. Even when we were to raise this, participants in our interviews really did not seem to believe that that was sort of a defining factor in this relationship. So they really saw this as a bellwether, as an indicator for what the relationship with the United States would be. Projecting what this would mean for the Philippines if the U.S. were to decrease its support for Taiwan is a little bit interesting, because we have seen relatively dramatic shifts in terms of the relationship with the Philippines and the United States and the PRC based off who is in power, and also based off of the type of action that China has been taking. So recently, as even on the Duterte administration, as China became more coercive or more assertive, the relationship between the two countries soured. But there's also the case that if you were to compare the early years of Duterte to the early years of Marcos, you'd see a very marked difference in the way that they treat these relationships. So our assessment was it'd be really contingent on who was in power and the type of relations they have at this time. So given that I've gone through the sort of case level findings, I'm going to pass it over to Jeffrey. Jeffrey, for some overall findings.
Thanks, Brian. And I'd also like to echo what both Miranda and Brian said, providing my thanks to Sasakawa Peace Foundation as well for this excellent partnership. So I will go over some of the overall findings, the top level look at what we found, and also provide some implications to close this discussion out, and then hear from our two commentators. If you look at the report, we have all our individual findings in these stoplight charts written in the reports. But so what we're providing you here are simply a summary of some of the findings. But when we look at the diplomacy side, the diplomatic policies here, what we find is that across these policies, that all three allies favor increasing high-level U.S.-Taiwan meetings, or I'm sorry, Japan does, but the ROK and the Philippines have some concerns. They're not fully on board with it. You see, by just looking at the stoplight chart there, Japan tends to have more support in any increases in diplomatic support across the levers of policies that we looked at. Whereas the Philippines and South Korea, they do have deeper concerns, more about an explicit U.S. commitment to Taiwan than Japan itself does. And so some, as Miranda said in her comments, and some of these things, and Brian provided explanations as well, these increases in high-level official interactions, for example, things like the Pelosi visit, you see more differences there with South Korea and the Philippines compared to Japan. Moving to the military, here you find there is, the yellow represents more of a mixed view, and all three allies support increases in U.S. Regional presence. Although, as Brian mentioned, the difference really here is on, for the Philippines, is it may depend in the future on who's in power. And when we look more across, and we had a lot of different variables that we looked at for the military, it does appear that South Korea and the Philippines, when compared to Japan, that they have deeper concerns about things, for example, like U.S. presence in or near Taiwan. The areas that did not prove to be very problematic across the board are these increases in intelligence sharing or economic cooperation. Across the board, we didn't have it on the stoplight chart here, but all three countries showed similar results, where if the U.S. would pursue policies that were trying to increase those areas, nobody took issue with that. What we found, what surprised us in some ways, was the uniformity in looking at policies of if the U.S. tried to reduce its support for Taiwan. Here we saw a lot of similarity of opposition of if the U.S. pursued those policies. And as was mentioned in Brian's individual case level findings, even though these three allies have official treaties with the United States and Taiwan does not, these countries saw any reduction of U.S. support to Taiwan as an indicator of U.S. declining U.S. commitment to themselves. And they also, if the U.S. would decrease its engagement with Taiwan, we believe that all three allies, findings show that all three allies would likely try to find ways to pull the United States closer because of the fear of a declining U.S. commitment to themselves. So looking at the implications, first looking at the implications for the United States, we tend to hear policymakers and scholars throw around the word a lot about like-minded allies. But what we have shown here is that, yes, these are treaty allies of the United States, but they have diverse views. And these diverse views could lead them to react in different ways to changes in U.S. policies, especially when we talk about something as sensitive as Taiwan. Their reactions could affect U.S. interests. If you think about U.S. foreign policy, you have in this administration promoting integrated deterrence, which relies a lot on working with friends and allies across various domains. How allies react to policies regarding Taiwan could therefore affect U.S. interests if they tried to do something that perhaps the allies were not fully on board with. And so thinking about whether the U.S. wants to engage allies to try to get support or pursue a policy on its own, how allies react should be part of any assessment of potential trade-offs if the U.S. decides to change its policy regarding Taiwan. And we also note that the reactions of how these allies react will change depending on the strategic setting. Brian mentioned that we did this research at the beginning of the Marcos administration. The Yun administration itself was relatively new, although it had been in about 6 months at the time that we started. As the strategic setting changes in the region, the reactions and how they would respond to some of these things might look different if a similar study was done 3-4 years from now. Finally, looking at the implications for Japan. Like the United States, looking at some of the expert debate that's happening in some of the Japanese security culture debates and policy analysts, there's a debate in Japan that about U.S. policy towards Taiwan that has similarly been overtaken by this narrow discussion of strategic ambiguity versus strategic clarity and what the United States should be doing regarding that, and or maybe what Japan should be doing. As Miranda said at the beginning of the discussion, we believe there is a potentially more fruitful discussion to be had about potential policy options that not just the United States, but also Japan could pursue regarding Taiwan. If we tend to look at it simply in terms of defending Taiwan or not defending Taiwan, we tend to narrow our potential policy options when there are a whole host of policy options out there that countries, not just the United States, but Japan also could pursue. And importantly, in this age where Japan and South Korea and the United States are finding greater trilateral alignment, where Japan, the Philippines, and the United States are also working closer together, we believe that findings like this show that it is possible that finding alignment with other regional allies may be easier in some areas. And because Taiwan is such a sensitive topic, having discussions about potential policy changes in the future, this could provide some ground, some foundation for those discussions. And with that, thank you. I will turn it over now to our experts, and we look forward to hearing their comments.
Dr. Onan, Dr. Preeb, Dr. Rooney, thank you so very much for going over the report, especially the three countries' findings. Thank you very much for a very thorough explanation. Even amongst U.S. treaty allies, depending on their conditions, their views, their reactions could differ. We have learned a great deal from this discussion. Thank you so very much. Now, we'd like to turn to Japanese experts, two of them, for their comments. First, from Sasakawa Peace Foundation, I'd like to hand it over to Mr. Watanabe, Senior Fellow, to talk about the report, especially focusing on Japan and South Korea. Handing over to you. Thank you very much. My name is Watanabe from Sasakawa Peace Foundation. I'm often referred to as Nabe, especially amongst the English-speaking people, so call me Nabe. Now, the RAND Corporation's report was indeed very timely, very interesting, and very useful. Of course, in Japan, as well as in the US, and ROK in the Philippines, this should be useful for everyone, but for Chinese as well, as they think about their policy, I think this would be useful. I don't know if any Chinese people are listening. It's difficult to talk about China when it comes to these matters, but implications on Japan and implications on the US. As I was hearing that, I was wondering what the implication would be on China. And with that in mind, I think you will be able to have a broader understanding of the meaning of this report. Simply put, my experience in recent past, Japan, US, and ROK, as you might know, there was that Camp David meeting. At Camp David, there was an attempt made to deepen the relationship between the three countries. And I had a chance to have a conversation with a Chinese security expert, and the Chinese were looking at very fierce, critically, that Camp David agreement and a meeting in between Japan, US, and ROK would lead to destabilization of the region. That is what the Chinese experts have said. And I could anticipate such a reaction from the Chinese. But let me give you the background. Prior to the current administration, there was the Moon Jae-in administration. There were three no's. Missile defense system, when it was deployed, the Chinese resisted, for example, stopping tourists going to ROK. There were three no's. Additional THAAD system would not be deployed, and they would not join missile defense with other countries, and there's not going to be a military alliance between Japan, US, and Korea. And after the Yoon administration started, Park Ching, the foreign minister, said that that was not a promise or not an agreement. So the Yoon administration would not follow that three no's. And to this, the Chinese experts are saying that that is not what we agreed to. So Chinese are complaining to Japan, but I would suppose that the Chinese are complaining even more fiercely to South Korea. So I would suppose that this Taiwan Strait issue is more serious. And as I have listened and as I have read this report, what I found very interesting is that we heard from Brian earlier that administration, for example, when you conducted interviews in South Korea, that was just the start of the new administration in South Korea. From Moon Jae-in administration to Yoon Suk-yeol administration, there was that transition. The same applies to the Philippines, from Duterte to Marcos administration. So it could change depending on who is in power. And there has been no change in government in Japan. But in Japan, direction does not change that much after a government change. So this is something that I found quite interesting. And I would suppose that in Japan, if there should be a Taiwan contingency, Japan is not in a position to be able to flee. So in terms of Japan's options, we need to fully engage the United States in this issue to be able to resolve the issue. By doing so, that could be deterrent to Chinese conduct. And even in the worst case scenario, Japan would like to work closely with the US to respond. Compared to this, South Korea and the Philippines, they have some distance away. They have other options as well. When I said distance, when you look at the differences in the region, if you look at the distance, South Korea is further away from Taiwan, and therefore the response is not as intense, and we can understand that. But is that all? What about the Philippines, the distance to them? Japan and Taiwan are very close, but also, the Philippines is very close to Taiwan, but in the case of the Philippines, when it comes to the crunch, the resolve to deal with the situation compared to the resolve we have in Japan, they still haven't made up their mind yet. And this is not the distance factor. I think this is the perception held by the government and the people of the Philippines. I think their perception is quite different from the perception held by the Japanese people. But currently, Japan working closely with the United States. We have already made up that mind and we're moving in that direction. And as I said, including South Korea, Japan-ROK relations have dramatically improved. So we're prepared to talk among the three countries. In that Camp David agreement, security for the region and the world, there's going to be close cooperation between the three countries. That was part of the agreement. A non-proliferation regime to be maintained is one piece of that. And Taiwan Strait's stability is also included in that agreement among the three countries. So Japan and South Korea and the US, the three countries' relationship to be stabilized would lead to stability in the Taiwan Straits. This is a positive factor in Taiwan Straits, but China is frustrated, so they're trying to challenge. So I think this is quite informative to the Chinese people who are viewing this. There is differences in the degree of enthusiasm, even between Japan, ROK, and US. If you are able to take advantage of the differences in the degree of enthusiasm, they could benefit. So in order for that not to happen, we need to further expand our relationship, not only amongst the three countries, but include the Philippines. I think that is one indication made in this report. Japan has very close relationship with the Philippines. We're acting very proactively to promote that relationship. I'm sure that this could be discussed by Dr. Kiba in her comment. So I would say that in many ways, this report is very informative, useful. We can learn a great deal and very meaningful. But I do have a number of questions. The first one is that, having said that, this report, the number of interviewees are limited, and the people who were interviewed in this research, government officials in the administration and the legislature, active members as well as retired people, those are the interviewees. So the number in the sample may be limited, rather small. So Japan is very positive. South Korea may be a bit further away, but it could differ depending on the government in power. The same is true in Japan. The experts and the bureaucrats may have similar thinking, but the Diet leaders, those leaders in the Diet finally take a direction forward. So LDP is partner Komeito would have different views, and the opposition parties also have different views. So I do not know how to what degree of detail the interviewee can express. If there could be some differences from political affiliation, if you have noticed that, I would like to hear about that as well. And another question, as I said at the beginning, a report like this, having read this report, China and Taiwan, people in Taiwan and China, what would they feel after having read this report? This isn't discussed in the report. So the three experts from the RAND Corporation, what would you say? How would they feel, people in China and Taiwan, would react having read this report? I talked about the Chinese possible response, but from the viewpoint of Taiwan, they may say that, of course, their relationship with the US is important and they value the relationship with Japan. But what about Philippines and South Korea? I would suppose that they would start to think that their relationship with the Philippines and South Korea is also important. So, not the, just the Taiwan side, but I would suppose that this should be conveyed to people in Korea as well as the Philippines. Thank you. That is all.
Mr. Watanabe, thank you very much. RAND Corporation experts, you have this urge to respond immediately, but before we give the floor to you, we would like to ask Dr. Kiba to make comments centering on the Philippines, and then we will give the microphone to the RAND Corporation side. Dr. Kiba, Please go ahead with your comment. Thank you very much. I read this report with great interest and there was lots to learn. The most novel point is the checkpoint. There was the matrix at the very end. You created those checkpoints and asked specific questions regarding expectations and concerns towards the United States. And Japan, RRP, and the Philippines being allies, you ask those checklist questions. These weren't open questions on what they want the United States to do or what they don't want the United States to do. And you came up with concrete hypotheses and asked specific questions in checklist format. That was quite interesting. So it probably made it easier for the respondents to be more critical vis-a-vis the United States. And we were able to capture and visualize the gut feeling of the policymaking elites of the allies. And as can be deciphered from the checklist, regarding U.S. engagement in Taiwan, there are differences in the expectations or concerns between the countries. And you see nuanced gradation. It's not simple. It's not linear. If you look at the checklist, we are in peacetime without any military clash. So this is the situation. This is the sentiment, even in peacetime. So what if, even in peacetime, there are concerns that certain action or posture by the United States may invite unnecessary misunderstanding or they may de-appreciate the U.S. So that was clarified. So that was very significant. Thank you very much. And I truly hope that U.S. policymakers will read this. 2022 was when administration changed in RRK and the Philippines. So this is a snapshot right after government change. But maybe you could do the same thing 2 years, 3 years time in order to see how the new policies have settled down. I'm going to focus on the Philippines because that's my expert field. I'm a regional researcher in Japan that has focused on the Philippines. But your analysis of the Philippines was very close to my intuitive impression. You show the table and the Philippines part is very red, does not support, occupies a large area, especially the high-level official interactions explicitly state that the United States will defend Taiwan, increase U.S. presence in or near Taiwan. And in those checklist items, the situation in the Philippines is does not support. As you mentioned in the presentation, what if there's disengagement by the United States? And the Philippines are also concerned about disengagement as well. So, as you say, the Philippines prefers that the United States, China, and Taiwan not rock the boat. That's a convenient way of expression, but it's very close to my theory as well. So, based upon that analysis, I have three questions. First question, what do you mean by trade-off? You use the expression trade-off. Jeffrey, you mentioned the potential trade-off. Trade-off between what and what? That point was unclear. In other words, if the United States does something that is not desirable for the allies, what is there for U.S. to lose? In peacetime, will the sentiment amongst the general public, especially in Japan, are okay, exacerbate vis-a-vis the United States, or will it become difficult for cooperation in times of contingency? So what's there for U.S. to lose? Secondly, in one same country, is there diversity amongst the policymaking elites? Both the Philippines and RRK are based upon the presidential system. So when a new president comes in, foreign policy can be completely reversed. Sometimes that happens. And regarding the Philippine part, there's much explanation about the first half of the Duterte administration. This is what he did, so this was the result. But my impression was that you were maybe too much bound by historical precedents. There was too much bias on that. Of course, it's not possible to take a snapshot of the situation pre-2022, but amongst Philippine researchers, we sometimes talk about the fact that even during the Duterte administration, even when his statements rocked Philippine-U.S. relationship, there were Philippine technocrats in the Defense Department and Foreign Department of the Philippines that tried to maintain their relationship with the United States. So the Philippines has a wealth of technocrats that try to do that, especially the AFP senior officials. Even in the previous administration, they were not overly influenced by the intentions of the president, and they tried to uphold their relationship with the United States. Did you feel that in your interviews, that kind of nuanced gradation? This is was done anonymous, on anonymous basis, but if you felt such change or difference, then please let us know, and that would be very, very important as you continue or we continue with such interviews. And also, the third question is probably out of your focus, but general public's view. In the interview, were there scenes where interviewees used business community or general public as an excuse or reason for not supporting some of the items? The Philippines are under a presidential system, so the policy elites are worried about what the mass would think. And also, the business sector of the Philippines maintain strong economic ties with China, and there are many powerful business persons who may be aggressive in lobbying the House or the Senate. So, and sometimes the Filipino policymaking elites would use the public opinion or business elites, business sector, as an excuse for not being able to do what the U.S. wants them to do or not being able to take diplomatic measures. Did you face those situations in your interviews? For example, did some of them say that this kind of action by the United States would not be approved by the business elites? Or did they use like public sentiment or business elites as excuses or reasons for not supporting? So those are my three questions. But as Nabe-san said, the Philippines and Japan are trying to strengthen bilateral economic ties. And the first 2+2 meeting was held under the Duterte administration. And also Japan chose Philippines as the first destination of defense equipment transfer. And OSA was announced. And between the Philippines and Japan, we've been talking about bilateral dialogue of things that the United States can do. So these would be very good reference as we think about the Filipino-Japan bilateral relationship too. Thank you very much for giving us those clues. Dr. Kiba, thank you very much. We heard from the two experts, and could we ask the RAND side to respond to those comments? There were 5 questions. Nabe first asked about the following through the interview. What about the difference in opinions regarding policymaking in Japan, the divide within Japan? Did you feel that? And the second point is the Chinese audience and the Taiwan audience. How would they feel when they read this report? And then Dr. Kiba asked 3 questions. The first question was potential trade-off between what and what. I think that's more of the Jeffries area, but what is there for the United States to lose in this kind of trade-off? That was the first question. And the second and third questions were regarding the Philippines. The second question is, within the Philippines, or even under the Duterte administration, there were people who tried to uphold the relationship with the United States. So there could be differences in opinions between the policy elite. Did you feel such difference as you engaged in the interview? And thirdly, in the interview, did they use the public sentiment or business community as excuses when they said that they can't support such actions by the United States? Did you encounter those cases? were there comments of such nature by the respondents? There were several other comments as well, so you can touch upon whatever you'd like to and freely respond to the comments. But let's go in the reverse order and start from Jeffrey.
Yeah, these are great, great questions. Thank you very much, both Nabe and Kiba-san, for these excellent questions. I'm very happy to get your input. I will take a first cut at some of these questions and then turn it over to my colleagues. Nabe, you asked the questions about sort of what would China think or the implications for China. You know, you referenced the Camp David meeting and the greater alignment of the of views among Japan, Korea, and the United States. I think if somebody from China reads this report and sees areas of alignment among U.S. allies, I think they would not be happy by seeing greater alignment among U.S. allies, because from a Chinese perspective, things work better when U.S. and its allies have gaps between their views. But when you asked about Taiwan, how would somebody from Taiwan view this? I think it depends on what aspect of the report they're looking at, to be honest with you. If they look at the fact that some countries that they do not, for instance, Korea and the Philippines, do not see Taiwan as directly relevant to their security, and that what happens with Taiwan is directly relevant to them, they might be a little concerned that these two U.S. allies do not view the Taiwan in that way. However, if someone looks at the fact that across the board, these three U.S. allies oppose reduction of U.S. Engagement with Taiwan, and that there is alignment on that fact, that they want the U.S. to maintain the status quo and try to push back in some ways, I think that would give somebody from Taiwan a bit of happiness to be able to read that and say, okay, these U.S. allies, they're at least supporting in that way. You asked the question about, or you mentioned about the limitation of some of the interviewees. Obviously, trying to do interviews in three different countries, coming from America and coming over and going to three different countries to do interviews, we're very limited in the amount of people we can engage. Add on top of that, the extra layer that the issue of Taiwan is a sensitive topic. Some government officials do not want to talk about it. Some politicians do not want to talk about it. And so we engaged where we could in terms of experts and officials that wanted and were willing to talk to us about it under the understanding that everything is 100% anonymous. We did not, I'll have to ask Brian to correct me if I'm wrong, we did not engage any opposition parties in any of the three countries. However, there were different views among the interviewee within country. And so we had Excel sheets, as Kiba-san was talking about our structured questions. We had Excel sheets within country with everybody, so we could compare and contrast their answers. And within country, there were differences in views. And so we tried to reflect that difference as much as we could in the report. And then I'll end with one, the Kiba-san's comment about the trade-offs. I'll comment on that, and I'll turn it over to Brian and Miranda to pick up some more. What I meant by that was the trade-off was if the United States, understanding that the allies have a view on these policies and that they might not necessarily agree with everything, the United States can pursue policies unilaterally with the understanding that its allies might not go along with it and that the effectiveness of those policies might not be there. Or it can try to find policies that its allies, there's some common ground for its allies to pursue together. And so there's a trade-off there about being able to go fast and quick with the policies you want or working with your allies, maybe not doing as far and as quick as you want, but finding policies where there's agreement so you could try to find more effective policies. That's what I meant by the trade-off. But I will turn it over to Brian or Miranda, and you can pick up some of the other threads that I left hanging.
I can go now, Jeffrey, because I do want to pick up on the other side of that, which is what you mentioned about, are they concerned about peacetime or are they concerned about a contingency? And so 2 points I want to make on that is the relationship between the United States and its allies and between, you know, different configurations of allies is important from a deterrent perspective, even short of a contingency, right? So alliance cohesion and alliance stability, I think that I would assess, and I think the team would assess, that that's really meaningful from a perspective of deterrence in some ways. And it also is the case that if there is a contingency situation, you know, there is a lot of room for what countries may do in a contingency, even within the bounds of a treaty agreement. And so, you know, one of the assessments that you want to make is that there is a necessity for the United States to be operating with its allies in mind and with its coalition in mind, because it isn't successful to operate outside of that structure. You know, I think that that is a sort of along the lines of what you're saying in terms of trade-offs as well. A couple of points that I'll touch on in terms of the relationship in the Philippines with the technocrats and particularly the Defense Department. You're completely right. We certainly experienced that. And I think that's not, that is something that comes out in the historical record. That's not, you know, entirely based off the interviews, but if you look at the defense strategies in the Philippines under Duterte, not significant drift towards China. They're actually still very heavily US focused, right? I think without, you know, dropping the cloud of anonymity too much, I think we can say that the AFP has strong relations with the US military. I think that those persisted sort of across time. And I think depending on who you were talking to and their position, you know, vis-a-vis those entities, you would probably get a different response. Specifically regarding the role of economic actors in the general public, there were definitely in the Philippines in particular, there was a lot of discussion of how the economic actors in the Philippines would see through actions that the United States was taking. I would say that that was something that came up repeatedly and at length, was the discussion of the power of different economic actors and, you know, the extent to which they have significant opinions on relations with the PRC. And there was some assessment that certain actions would not be palatable to those communities. I would say less so for public opinion, particularly in the Philippines. I don't think that was a significant sort of calling point for them. Although historically, public opinion towards the United States and the Philippines, as you know, is tremendously high. So I think that might go a little bit of the way in terms of explaining that. Not to continue talking, but I do love talking. I think to the question of how should Taiwan be viewing this, I think it's a really interesting question. And I think I have an answer, and I'll give that answer with the caveat that this is my answer alone, and it does not necessarily represent ground truth. But if I'm Taiwan and I'm reading this, then I'm beginning to understand how important it is to make sure that your relationships with the rest of the regional states are strong. Because if I'm looking at this and I'm reading this and I'm thinking about the Philippines, there's a lot of mixed feeling in the Philippines, and there is a reluctance, Nabe-san, as you said, there's a reluctance to make a choice and to take a side, right? There is still a persistent belief that you can continue to stay in the middle of two poles, even as they begin to split. And I think Taiwan might see that as a place in which they can take an active role and say, you know, this isn't about the relationship between the two poles. It's actually about the relationship between Taiwan and the Philippines, who have very close economic ties. I think that's just one example of how I would look at this from the perspective of Taiwan and say, you know, I'm not a passive actor in this. I can actually, you know, make some moves. I think the way that I would look at that is to say, here are the levers that, you know, are places in which the United States could go closer to Taiwan. Maybe those are also levers in which Taiwan can think about interacting with other states. I also think, just to your overall point, and, you know, doubling back to sort of the first thing I said, is that the relationships between all of the parties in this are very important, right? We looked at this from the discrete perspective of, you know, we asked questions in the Philippines, we asked questions in Korea, we asked questions in Tokyo. But it was never independent of the understanding that the United States has relationships with all these countries, and the United States, all of these countries have relationships with one another, and all of these countries have relationships with Taiwan. And so there was always this understanding that there is this larger sort of macro structure that's dictating what's going on. And so it's really important to highlight that and keep that in mind, that we're presenting a very particular assessment based off of what were truly discrete questions meant to get at specific answers. But it is operating in a system, and sort of that system level effect is really important, particularly when we think about things like the relationship between Japan and South Korea, Japan and the Philippines, right? Those are actors who have their own relationship. So I think that's really important to highlight, and I'll stop right there.
I know we want to get to question and answer, so I'll just add a brief comment to what Brian and Jeffrey already said, which is to really thank Nabe-san and Saya-san for reminding the audience that, you know, these findings are really a snapshot in time, that there's a lot of things that are evolving, that governments can change, that the strategic setting change, for example, China's behavior could change over time, as well as, you know, we're seeing that, as Brian, I think, really clearly explained in the presentation, that views in Korea as well as in the Philippines are evolving, that there's a conversation where this is a newer area of focus for them. And so I thank you for helping us remind the audience that, you know, in 5 years, we might have different answers than we have today.
Thank you very much. We heard from the three experts from the RAND Corporation. Nabe-san, Dr. Kiba, anything you wish to add? Comments to the response to your comments? Nabe-san. Thank you very much. Thank you for clearly answering all the questions. I expected those questions, but one point I would like to reaffirm is that this is purely a snapshot and evolves minute by minute. So it's probably changed since the timing you had the interview. So much so, all the more so because of that, this visualizes the broad trend. So if you do it at a different timing, maybe if we take a snapshot today, we will be able to distinguish what has changed and what has not changed. So it was very meaningful. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. How about you, Dr. Kiba? Thank you. Similar to Nabe-san, that was the feeling. And thank you very much for your answer about trade-off. Both peace times and contingencies, these are the likely responses. So how they should respond. I think this is going to be great material for the U.S. to consider how to react. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We have received a few questions, so we would like to now take up the questions that we have received from the listeners. First of all, the first question is with regards to the policy taken by the Trump administration. I'm going to read it in English.
Have you found any difference of opinion among three allies regarding the Trump administration's declassification of the six assurances? Also, in retrospect, do you think that declassification was a good policy decision or not, in terms of building more stable strategic architecture in this region? ということで、こちらについては、
ランド研究所の皆様の。So, who would like to respond? maybe all three would like to respond, or who would like to respond? Anyone who would volunteer? Jeffrey, please.
Yeah, I mean, I'll quickly say that when we were doing the research, we did not necessarily ask specific questions about recent policy changes or recent things that a specific administration did. The questions, well, we looked at the historical change back in the 70s when the United States changed from recognizing Taipei to Beijing. We looked at that for our individual chapters. The content of the chapters were more forward-looking, as Miranda said. We were looking at hypothetical changes. And so, unfortunately, for this specific question, this was not something we examined in our research.
So the next question is about southwestern islands of Japan. This is also a question given in English, so let me read this.
The islanders of Yonaguni and Ishigaki, the closest Japanese islands to Taiwan, have begun discussing escape plans. How likely do you think Okinawa, with the numerous US and JSDF bases, will be part of the battlefield if war were to break out over Taiwan?
So I can go first on answering this question. I can say that this will not be a happy answer. I am of the firm assessment that if war to break out over Taiwan, the chances of Okinawa being part of the battlefield are, I would say it's a virtual certainty. I don't want to say it's an entire certainty, but I find a conflict in which I find it very hard to think of a realization of this conflict that does not involve some level of war over Southwest Islands. And I think given the presence of the United States and co-located and in bases of its own, I think it is very, very unlikely that those bases would be untouched. So I think that they would be at significant risk of entering the conflict. Very pessimistic view, I know, but in my honest assessment, I see very few pathways through which that does not occur.
I would add to that, Nabe-san, in his remarks, he made the point that about countries needing to fully engage the issue. And I think even though the question was specifically about Yonaguni, I think this speaks to the broader issue that something that we did bring out in our report and Nabe's question in particular, that this needs, the issue of Taiwan is relevant not just for the people of Yonaguni or the people in the Nansei Shoto, but it is relevant for the region, because if a war did occur, war is not predictable. You do not know where it will expand to, where it will end up. And so this could end up in the Philippines. It could end up in Nansei Shoto. It could end up in Korea. Yes, I agree with Nabe that distance makes thing people tend to ignore it. They think, oh, we're far enough away, it's not going to affect us. But there's no guarantee to that. And so I do think that it just, the question did spark to me Nabe's comment that this is an issue that I think the people of the countries that we examined in our research, having a more broader discussion, public debate, public discussion to more fully engage the issue, I think is critical.
Nabe-san, Mr. Watanabe, do you have any comments to make to this question? This question, the question was about Yonaguni Island and being close. They're even starting to think about escape plans. Former Prime Minister Abe, he said that Taiwan contingency is Japan's contingency. This is a reality. The same with the contingency on the Korean Peninsula, but in terms of distance and closeness, obviously,
If you're closer,
you tend to think about the issue more seriously.
So escape
plans
was mentioned.
People, obviously, many people will start to flee from Taiwan, including Japanese. And if you're in Yonaguni, it's very, very close. So you can get to Yonaguni very quickly by boat. So that is also another thing that we have to think about when you are very close to Taiwan, like Yonaguni and Okinawa. Jeffrey, as he indicated, when it is a military contingency, even if you are some distance away, you cannot rest assured and feel safe given the current military capability. For example, missile targeting, it's not just Okinawa that people have to worry about. This is about whole of Japan. And although this wasn't discussed particularly today, Korean Peninsula contingency and Taiwan contingency may be linked. They could be linked. It's also discussed in the report. So Taiwan contingency could be our contingency in Japan as well as Philippines and South Korea, because and the same thing can apply to the contingency on the Korean Peninsula. So these are negative things that we don't want to think about, but because it is negative, we have to have a good debate to prepare ourselves, and that preparation could lead to deterrence so that we can avoid the negative consequences. That is what is important.
渡辺さん、どうもありがとうございました。たくさん、質問を。
渡辺さん、thank you very much. We have received many questions, but
一つ、このレポートの最初の問題意識のところに関連してご質問いただいて、
There is a question regarding the first part of the report. This is in English, so I'll read in English.
How real is the change of the US policy towards Taiwan? Meaning the shift from strategic ambiguity to strategic clarity. Do you expect that the upcoming US election will contribute to that? こちらの質問に、ついて、RAND研究所の皆様。
I would like to respond to this question. From the RAND Corporation side. Jeff, please.
Well, I'll take the first thoughts at this. Again, part of the motivation behind this report, as Miranda said at the beginning, was to try to expand the debate beyond just strategic ambiguity versus strategic clarity. Now, we don't believe that our report's going to change that debate and that people are going to suddenly start talking about all these policy levers that we've examined, but we've tried to provide a richer discussion for that. The question though, you know, the fundamental question that the person asked about how real is the change? I would flip that and say, how real is the possibility for the US right now to change its policy toward Taiwan? Some people have argued that President Biden's statement four times about defending Taiwan and then it being walked back by either the White House or the State Department saying nothing's changed. Some people have argued that the U.S. policy has already changed, that it has moved somewhat closer. I think I could speak for my colleagues here. Whether or not the U.S. tries to declare strategic clarity or say something toward that end or stay at strategic ambiguity, I think that what the U.S. could do in many different areas and to try, if it does decide to strengthen relations with Taiwan or weaken relations with Taiwan, what it decides to do is not boiled down to just one choice between clarity or ambiguity. There's a whole host of options that the U.S. has at its at its lever that it can pull. And what we hope to provide in this report is that it has three allies in the region, and that for the effectiveness of those policies, there's considerations about what the U.S. allies want and what trade-offs the U.S. would have to consider, whether it goes it alone or goes it with the allies. And so I think I feel comfortable answering like that, as opposed to predicting what the next U.S. election is going to bring, because quite frankly, I don't know what U.S. politics is going to even bring tomorrow. So I'll leave it at that.
Just to pick up on that a little bit, I'll answer in a slightly different but similar fashion, which is to say, if we consider it a shift between strategic ambiguity and strategic clarity, then I think that a shift is less likely. But I would note that the relationship between the United States and Taiwan is always shifting. And it's shifting along some of the axes that we describe in this report. And some of the changes that we are suggesting might take place in the future are indicative of things that have taken place in the past, right? So while the Speaker Pelosi visit was not a shift between strategic ambiguity and strategic clarity, that's the type of shift that we do see governments taking. And so while I don't know what form the shift in relations will be, I feel pretty confident in saying that the relationship between the United States and Taiwan will take on some new form and some new characteristics, regardless of the outcome of the presidential election. And I think that is part and parcel of the U.S. focus toward the region, and also, its relationship with the other, with its allies and with its, competitors in that region. And so I don't think we should ever be thinking about this as a static relationship, because I don't think that it is. I think it's constantly changing. And that's why I think Jeffrey's point about trying to get at some of this nuance is so important, is because we're actually missing what I believe to be relatively significant changes in the relationship if we're just focusing on strategic clarity, strategic ambiguity. And it feels like the allies that we've spoken with, they also view these changes as potentially significant. And so that's how I would similar answer that question.
I'll only add that there's a lot of discord in U.S. policy these days, as I'm sure you're all aware, but actually U.S. Views about policy in the Indo-Pacific are much more unified than in other areas. The current policy towards China, towards Taiwan, towards the region, is an area of bipartisan consensus that we don't see in a lot of other areas. So, I really echo what Brian and Jeffrey said, that if we focus on this binary, we miss a lot of the change that has already happened, but also that there's a lot of agreement on the change that has happened. And so, right now it seems like there's support for the current approach. And but as Jeffrey said, you can't really predict what's going to happen next these days. So.
Thank
you very much. Time flies and we only have 5 minutes left. So I'd like to pick up about two questions, pick them up, and try to get the answer to those questions. And if there are other things that you would like to comment on as we have had this discussion, new thoughts that you have, or message that you would like to convey to the audience, I would give a chance to each one of you to make it your last chance to make concluding remarks. But to start with, let me just pick two questions, share the questions with you. First one is about this research. Similar research? Do you intend to conduct similar research in other countries? Do you have any such plan, such as Vietnam, Indonesia, Singapore, or India? Are there any plans to conduct the same study in these countries? So that's the first question. And the next question is, this is in English, so I'm going to just read it out.
Stopping Taiwan contingency from happening was the policy priority in all the three countries? 質問ですね、question. If so, what would ROK and the Philippines want to see happen for that purposes if they don't support higher U.S. presence near Taiwan?
So these are the questions, especially in particular to South Korea and the Philippines, their position. The latter question was about what they think. So you can answer these questions or you can make other comments. So this is going to be a chance to make your last concluding remark. Starting with, or including the Japanese experts, let us go to the original order, starting with Miranda, Brian, Jeffrey, and Watanabe-sensei, and Dr. Kiba, in that order, please.
Well, unfortunately, we don't have plans to, current plans to continue this research in other countries, but hopefully someone else might be inspired from this discussion to take up the charge next. Second, I would just say that I'll let Brian and Jeffrey speak in more detail about each country, but you know, I think that's a really, the second question was a really great point, which is that it is clear that all of these countries want to avoid war in the Taiwan Strait, that avoiding conflict is a top priority that all of the allies share.
So just to pick up on that, I think it really depends on your perspective of how you think that the PRC is going to behave and how you think Taiwan is going to behave. Because my assessment, at least from this research and my other research, is that there is a fine line between deterrence and sort of containment or threat or provocation or any of those other terms that China at least likes to, you know, say as part of their rhetoric that they believe that this is what the United States is doing. And so if you believe that conflict is unlikely unless something happens to provoke it, then I think you want to maintain the status quo and you don't want to increase the U.S. presence. If you think that the U.S. presence is what is actively deterring what would otherwise be an ongoing conflict, and as China continues to modernize and continues to become militarily stronger, then you would think that the United States presence needs to increase. But it all comes from that frame of what do you think the likely driver of conflict is going to be? And I think a lot of the people that we talked to had different opinions on that. And they had different assessments as to whether this is something that could be avoided simply by, you know, continuing to make small movements or maintaining the status quo, or whether this was something that was already trending towards a certain direction that needed to be defended against. And so I would say, to me, at least, that's the stark distinction that was made and why some favored less action or even inaction on the part of the United States. It was because they had a different perspective of the way that the PRC was going to be trending in terms of their desires, in terms of their willingness to carry something like this out. And I think that's really fundamental, is to never forget, you know, the PRC gets a vote in a Taiwan war. And so if you take that vote into account, it really dramatically shapes what you think is going to happen.
My final couple thoughts here. First of all, Nabe, Kiba-san, thank you all. Thank you also, Sasakawa Peace Foundation, for hosting this wonderful session where we could hear such great comments from Kiba-san and Nabe. My thoughts here, and it was on that question about what to do from stop a contingency from happening. Nobody wants a war. That's very clear. Nobody wants it. And the differences of opinion that we found when we were researching really amplified that. There are differences, but it's differences in how to stop provocations and sort of how to maintain stability or push back against provocations in peacetime. But one of the things that I think is really important here, we tend to, as analysts, sometimes we talk about things in a very generic way. We talk about strategic clarity, strategic ambiguity. We throw around deterrence theory. We throw around all these political science and IR theories to try to explain this. But this is a real problem where people are facing, that people in the region are facing. One of the value of this kind of research is we listened to the perspectives of people in the region to find out what they thought, what they feared, what they expected and hoped for. I think this is the kind of quality research that really does provide voice to what is otherwise just this generic topic that gets talked about by experts. And so I want to leave with that to try to remember the human element to a lot of these discussions. But again, thank you, Sasakawa Heiwa-Zaidan and Nabe-san and Kiba-san for the excellent comments.
Nabe-san, your final words. Thank you. In fact, Taiwan contingency desktop exercise, I participated in one, and the scenario was written by an American. And what all the Japanese participants of that desktop tabletop exercise thought was that it's just US and China thinking, and the Taiwanese opinion isn't reflected, and there's no perspective of Japan or the Philippines or other allies. And if there's a debate for the presidential election, then the debate will tilt towards America only, what America does in China, without any perspectives of other countries. So as Jeff said, there's so many residents of Taiwan. And in Japan and in the Philippines, there is a huge population. And they may face tragedy. So based upon that kind of possibility, I think there ought to be debate in the United States. We hope that those elements are considered by the Chinese side as well. So we hope that the perspective of allies would be researched more. So we're really appreciative that you had taken that initiative. Jeffrey, Rand Corporation, researchers, we're truly thankful. This is a wonderful job. Well done. You have this English report, and we hopefully this will have some impact to the debate in the United States, which the Japanese would very much appreciate.
Dr. Kiba, thank you. This research by the RAND Corporation, strategic ambiguity, how do allies think about strategic ambiguity? That was not the focus of this research. It's beyond that. And perspectives beyond strategic ambiguity was provided in the research. In the checklist, the red section, I think it's important that we all share our understanding about those red boxes and about the Philippines. Security experts and policy elites, they do exist, but they have shortage of defense capacity and experience. And that is reflected in this report. So in the questions, Japan, US, South Korea, Philippines, and Taiwan, five-party collaboration, plus India and Singapore. So how can, defense capacity shortage of Philippines is quite clear. So they cannot have dialogue as equal partners. So including governance, various city building has to be made in the Philippines by doing as they do that. Various defense cooperation and training could be conducted to understanding to change this snapshot. I consider important. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jeffrey, Miranda, Brian, Dr. Kiba, Nabe-san. We're truly thankful for the insightful debate and great summarization. We apologize for overboarding the closing time, but Jeffrey, Nabe, and everyone summarized well. And as they said, we can't just simply do this binary thinking of is it ambiguity or clarity, because it's a complex world. Jeffrey, you put the word very correctly. The human element has to be focused, and the allies and the people of Taiwan, these are factors that we need to take into consideration, and those are factors that need to be reflected in the policy choices. So those were what you said. We are in a harsh environment, all the more so because we are in such an environment, the human perspective is of greater importance. Of course, this is a snapshot which can change with passage of time, and there are perspectives of other countries that are not covered in this research, but we truly hope for the evolution of this research and the evolution of our way of thinking. We know you're all extremely busy. We were blessed with 5 great experts. Thank you for your participation. This will be the end of today's webinar. Those who have signed up, thank you to the audience, and thank you to the interpreters. Were very clear, will appear on the screen, and we'd very much appreciate it if we could receive your feedback. This will be the closing of the seminar. Once again, thank you.